what I want to do is kind of sketch how I think about moral truth, which is pretty close, I think, to how St. Thomas thinks about moral truth. So I do contemporary philosophy. So the people that I engage with in my writing are other contemporary philosophers, by and large. But I tend to have a constant dialogue with Thomas Aquinas. Like, he's one of the main people that I draw upon, in large part because I think a lot of what Thomas says makes a lot of sense. So when I read him, I was an atheist, and I was 18 years old, and I was just totally struck by how much sense it made. Really amazing. Did not expect that. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about what Aquinas thinks truth is, how he thinks about truth generally, and then move into thinking about moral truth and moral knowledge. And so I'll say some things to try to distinguish it from other kinds of knowledge that we might acquire in life. And then I'm going to talk about practical reasoning and the virtues. And then at the end, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about this concept, practical truth. I think that moral truth is a kind of practical truth, but what does that really mean? So, quid est veritas, right? That's the question that Pontius Pilate asks Christ right before he's condemned to death. What is truth? And I find the way that Aquinas thinks about truth very helpful. So truth is just defined in relation to the power of intellect that we possess. And I think of truth as something that both defines an act of intellect as an intellectual act, and also something that provides it with a measure of success or failure. So the intellect is just your capacity for knowledge or for understanding things. That's a capacity that we all have. We all know the difference between knowing and understanding something and not knowing or understanding it, being ignorant. So when we talk about intellect, we're just talking about that capacity. And that capacity relates one to being, to reality, to things, by way of truth. So a judgment or a belief is good or bad, is good if it's true. Right? So that's the thumbs up. If your belief is true, it's a good belief. And it's bad if it's false. And to be false is just to fail to be true. Now, for a judgment or a belief to be true is to relate the person who judges to reality in the right way. So to know that there's a podium here is to be related to the podium in a certain way. And Aquinas describes this as an adequatio. So that's just a Latin word, but you might think as a kind of conformity or adequation between my judgment and the mind and the way things really are. So suppose I come to believe that there is a podium there, which seems like a reasonable belief. That's just to take a certain proposition that there is a podium there to be true. And if I assert this, it's just to say the way I think things really are. There's a contemporary philosopher named Richard Moran who teaches at Harvard who argues that belief is transparent to the truth. And what he means by that is kind of from the first person perspective of someone who forms a belief or who is deliberating about what to believe, I treat the question about my belief that the podium is there as equivalent to the question of whether it's true that the podium is there. So the one question is, in a sense, transparent to the other question. And that means that if I'm deliberating about whether to believe that there's a podium there, I'm deliberating about whether it's the case that this state of affairs obtains in the world independently of me. So when I'm trying to make up my mind, when I'm trying to decide about what to believe, I'm trying to figure out the truth. So the activity of believing and deliberating is unintelligible without reference to truth. And I think this is captured in Aquinas' definition, right? The truth is defined in relation to our intellectual operation. And just to underscore how tight the connection is between belief, truth, and reality, consider the following kind of situation. Imagine somebody thinking to himself, as he looks out the window, that it's raining. It's not raining, but just imagine that it's raining. And then conjoining this with the thought that he doesn't believe that it's raining. That seems impossible. And the fact that this seems impossible shows the tight connection between making a judgment or forming a belief and the thought that it's true, that it's really the case. And so there was a 20th century philosopher who was super famous named Ludwig Wittgenstein. And in his philosophical investigations, he wrote that if there were a verb that meant to believe falsely, it would not have any significant first-person present indicative. So, like, if this verb existed, I wouldn't be able to deploy it in my first-person activity. I wouldn't be able to assert it. And the reason for this is, again, that to believe something is to have settled the question for oneself about the way things really are. Now, of course, you might be wrong, and sometimes we are wrong about the way things are, even when we've thought about it quite a bit. So go back 100 years in science, and everybody's talking about phlogiston. Well, nobody believes that phlogiston exists anymore. But people thought they had reasons to believe that phlogiston existed. So look, you might be wrong. But the point is that to believe something is to make a claim that can, in principle, be correct or incorrect. And the measure is truth, the way things really are, or reality itself. So if you stop believing in phlogiston, it's because it turns out you don't think that there's anything in reality that corresponds to this concept, probably because you figured out a different concept. Okay. So, I think what is important about this is that it underscores the following point. We cannot help but be ordered to the truth. So just in virtue of having an intellect, of being the kind of creature who makes judgments, informs beliefs, and deliberates, we are ordered to the truth. So we cannot avoid seeking what is objectively true any more than we can avoid being a human being. And when people try to deny the truth, they end up contradicting themselves and not being intelligible. So imagine somebody who says, I don't believe in objective truth. People like this are trying to assert something true, right? But it's self-defeating. They're sort of like undercutting themselves, right? Because if you don't believe in truth, then you can't believe it's true that there's no truth. And obviously you're not going to get very far in life denying truth. And it's also it also underscores the fact that when people say things, which they say all the time in a well-meaning way, people say things like, well, it's my truth, right? Truth isn't something that just any one person possesses. There's not like my beautiful truth and your beautiful truth, and they might be totally different because, again, truth is about reality, the way things are. So if I say something true, then in principle, you can come see the same truth because we both have that capacity to exercise our intellect. And truth is something that measures that. So we can't avoid truth, and truth is shareable. Let's put it that way. And one of the reasons why it's shareable is because it has to do with reality or the way things are. Okay, so that's like just some basic stuff about truth. Happy to answer any questions about that. But what I want to focus on is moral truth. What is moral truth? So maybe you might think, oh yeah, we can know truths about stuff, but like morality, there's no truth about morality. That's just like whatever I say it is. So I'm going to assume that there is something that is moral truth. So your beliefs about what to do might be good or bad, and the measure of that is going to be truth. But I think the moral truth is somewhat different from the kind of truth that I've been talking about so far. But when he asks the question, what is moral truth, there's a prior question that, in a sense, has already been settled, but maybe in the wrong way. And so the prior question is, well, what's morality, right? And now, here I want us to think with Aquinas, but to acknowledge that the way that Aquinas thinks about morality is somewhat foreign to the way that we speak about it in contemporary language. So you might think about morality as some really super special part of human life, like really important, really weighty parts. But Aquinas really rejects that view. So Aquinas says that everything you do is moral. So did you drink coffee this morning? That's moral. Did you have some Cheerios? That's moral. Did you make a promise and keep it? That's also moral. basically, everything you do is moral. So it's not like the moral things are things like keeping my promises or keeping my contracts or like not killing anyone. Those things are all important. But Aquinas thinks that everything you do is moral. What does he mean by that? Aquinas says in the Summa that all human acts are moral acts. And what he means by that is that all human acts are either good or bad as human acts. So like everything you do, drinking your coffee this morning, that was either good or bad. And it's good if it's in no way bad. Okay, so how could drinking coffee be bad? Well, was it stolen? Did your doctor say, absolutely don't drink coffee, it's killing you? You know, was your kid like crying out in pain and you're like, whatever, I need my coffee? Or was it just a totally normal morning and you drink coffee because you need coffee? Then your drinking coffee was good, right? But you can imagine certain circumstances where drinking the coffee wouldn't be good. I mentioned three of them. You could cook up like 1,000 more. So every act is moral in the sense that it's either good or bad as a human act. So no particular human act, no matter how trivial it seems, is morally indifferent. Everything is either good or bad as a human act. Now, in order to really understand this formula, I think we have to look at what makes an act human. And what Aquinas says there is that an act is human if it comes about through the exercise of free will. And by free will, he just means a free judgment, so a judgment that you ought to do something, and then a choice that is going to be an execution of that judgment. So, what is the measure of a human act? How can we say that a human act is good or bad? What's the measure? I said that the measure of an act of an intellect is truth. Well, what's a measure of an act of will, right? The capacity to will would be the capacity to wish for things, to hope for things, but most fundamentally to intend to do things and make choices. And what Aquinas says here is that an act is good insofar as it truly constitutes or contributes to human fulfillment, or what he calls beatitudo, which is translated as happiness. So the measure of the goodness or badness of an action is whether or not it contributes to the highest human good, human happiness. And an action is good insofar as it does constitute a good, happy life, could be described as part of a good or happy life. And it's bad if it fails to do that. So this also means that the point or purpose of the moral life which for Aquinas just means the point or purpose of human life generally is to be happy. So when we think about morality, we're not fundamentally thinking about rules or commands, although morality does involve rules and commands, but any rule or command is justified in virtue of its relationship to happiness. Really what we're talking about when we talk about the moral life is happiness or deep human fulfillment and what's necessary to attain that. So Aquinas thinks that we're ordered to happiness in virtue of making practical judgments and choices. So let's, I want to think about this a little bit with respect to practical deliberation. So we have to deliberate about what to believe, but we also have to deliberate about what to do, right? So everybody decided, for whatever reason, to come to this talk. and, you know, you had to think about it, because obviously there are other things you could be doing right now. Many of them, I'm sure, are quite wonderful. So why did you decide to come here? Well, you know, you went through some process of deliberation. And presumably, you thought that coming to this talk was in some sense good. And practical deliberation is about trying to realize the good, right? So when we deliberate about what to do, we're trying to think about actions that in some sense are going to help us given whatever it is that we're doing in life. So maybe you came to this talk because you're confused about moral truth and you thought, hey, maybe I'll understand this better. Maybe you came to the talk just because you love Aquinas and you're like, hey, there's an Aquinas thing happening. That sounds awesome. You know, anyway, maybe you came to this talk because you wanted to impress someone. Again, that's just another way of realizing some good that you can see for yourself. So practical deliberation is different from theoretical deliberation in that it's ordered to action. And ultimately, it's ordered to living well. Like, you know, we engage in particular acts because, like, we want to be living a good life. We want to be living well. Now, that's when we talk about living well, for Aquinas, that's interchangeable with talk about happiness. So, like, really, the ultimate goal of your practical deliberation is happiness. So, like, what is it that you're really trying to realize? A good and happy life. And when your deliberation is good, that's what you realize for yourself. Now, how do we understand happiness or living well? Well, I don't think it can just be whatever feels good to you. For anything that feels good to you, it's an open question whether it's really or truly good for you. The fact that it feels good to you doesn't decide it. And part of the reason for saying this is that behind every appearance of the good, so some things like really appear good to us, but the appearance is false. Like there's sort of a darker reality behind the appearance. I work a lot with psychologists, in part because I write a lot about happiness, and psychologists do a ton of empirical work on happiness. Some of it's good, some of it's really questionable. But one of the things that we have learned from psychology is that human beings are incredibly unreliable self-reporters of their own happiness. There's just so much evidence for this. So, like, but I'll just give you a simple example of how this can go wrong. So think about a woman who you ask her, like, are you happy? And she says yes. She seems very happy with her life. But it turns out that she's not aware of how her life is really going. So the most important thing to her is her marriage and her love for her spouse. And she thinks they have a great relationship, and so she feels very happy and satisfied. What she doesn't know is that her spouse is cheating on her. Her spouse is planning to take all of their life savings and run away with this other woman. If she knew what her life was really like, she would be extremely sad and miserable, but she doesn't know, right? So she feels very fulfilled, but her feelings really don't match the reality. And that's just sort of like an extreme case of something that I think is very common. That is to say, people can feel really good about things, and just objectively speaking, they should not. So how can we distinguish between a kind of false fulfillment and a kind of real, genuine fulfillment? That's an important and deep question. And what Aquinas says about it is that human fulfillment in the deep sense, so we talk about true happiness, not just that you feel happy, although if you're truly happy, you will feel happy. that it's not just the appearances, but the reality. We have to tie our conception of happiness to objective human goods so that we can look at your life. There's like your perspective on your life, which is somewhat limited, because we can be pretty self-deceived about things, or we can be deceived by other people about things. But someone from a pretty objective third-person perspective could look at your life and be like, yeah, you are living a good human life. Like, it, you know, your fulfillment is, like, real and deep. And in order to get that kind of external check, you need to have a notion of what is objectively good for a human person. So what kinds of ends and goals and things are worth having in life, worth going after? And Aquinas thinks with Aristotle and Plato on this question, and Augustine, and thinking that the answer to that comes in an account of human nature. So, you know, everybody in this room is like a unique, beautiful snowflake of a person, unrepeatable. But at the same time, each one of us is the same. Okay, so we all are individual members of the same species. We're all human beings. So we're all bearers of the same human form. Even men and women, different as we are both fully human beings. And so it's this account of what the human person is, objectively speaking, that determines what human good is. And of course, you'll all live your own unique, unrepeatable, beautiful individual lives, right? Such that one way of living well or being happy doesn't look identical to any other way. But there are certain similarities that we see that allow us to talk about the happy life or the good life in general. Okay, so we need this account of human nature. And this account of nature is much broader than the human person. So all living things have natures, right? And that means for Aquinas, among other things, that all living things possess the potential to achieve something like their perfected condition, where your perfected condition is a story about how the potentiality that's inherent to you is the kind of thing that you are, with the powers and capacities that you possess, to be fully actualized or fully realized. So to take an example, think about an acorn and an oak tree, right? And I mean like a full flourishing, like I'm down south, so I'm thinking like a 500-year-old oak on a plantation. It's just majestic. Now, every acorn is potentially this majestic oak. Most acorns, not going to be oaks, right? Even the acorns that, like, start to be oaks fail. But they all have the potential to realize this beautiful condition. And in a similar way, every human person is potentially happy. Most humans, not going to be happy. They're going to fail in spectacular ways. But they all have the potential to be happy. And that just means that we all have these capacities that make us human. So for Aquinas, those are capacities of intellect and will. And when these are exercised to the greatest possible extent, that would be our perfected condition. And that's what Aquinas means by happiness, is the full actualization of our potential as human persons. So a happy or a good human life is one that is directed towards the highest good a human being can attain, where the highest good is that which most perfectly perfects our nature. And the question of moral knowledge is the question of how we know what that is, right? So Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics has this wonderful imagery of the archer trying to hit the target. And Aristotle points out, well, you can't hit the target unless you know where it is, right? And so similarly, in the moral life, you're not going to hit the goal if you don't know what the goal is, right? And so moral knowledge is, at its most general and fundamental level, understanding what human happiness actually consists in. Okay, so moral knowledge is practical self-knowledge. This is the next thing that I want to try to explain. I just want to draw a distinction between the knowledge that we have of objects that are distinct from us and the knowledge that we have of our own activity and operation. So I know things in the world by and large empirically. Like, I observe them, I see what's going on, I come to form some general concepts, but I can only do that by, like, interacting with stuff through the senses, right? I get sensory information. It's empirical knowledge. There are other kinds of objects that I might know non-empirically, like triangles and numbers. So people who do, like, mathematical proofs, they end up having knowledge about triangles that they get through doing complicated proofs and formulas, not by going out and staring at all the triangles they see in the world, which are all imperfect triangles. They're just thinking about the form of the triangle. but that's a kind of object, right? Neither of these are self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is gained through reflection upon my own activity. Disciplined reflection upon my own activity. So think back to the activity of coming to form a belief, right? And think about how you know what you believe. You don't know what you believe by, like, searching your mind. you know what you believe by thinking through your reasons for believing it. Suppose you forget what you believe. Then you have to go back and think through it again. I know what I believe in virtue of having determined what I'm going to believe, right? And I can reflect on this activity of theoretical deliberation and knowledge in a philosophical way. That kind of reflection on my own activity yields a kind of self-knowledge. And I think of knowledge of human nature as, first and foremost, it's not exhaustive, but I think first and foremost, it's that kind of knowledge. It's reflective knowledge on our own experience from inside of it. So when I come to know my own activity, it's different from coming to know, like, another object, because the self, the I, and the I think, and the I do, and the I choose, and the I love, and things like this, isn't a funny kind of object. So, like, the I isn't, like, a funny thing trapped inside myself. It is let's just call it self-knowledge, okay? And let's just distinguish that between knowledge of objects, which are distinct from the self. Now, I don't know what I think or what I do as a matter of discovery or observation in the same way that I know objects. I determine what I think in making judgments and deliberating, and simultaneously, I determine what I do through practical deliberation and making a choice. I think it's important that moral knowledge is a kind of self-knowledge, because if it weren't, then we would leave it to the empirical scientists. We would just look to the anthropologist to tell us what moral truth is, or we would look to the biologist. The biologist studies the human being as an object. The biologist looks at us like any other object. We're interesting, and you can know a lot about human beings by studying them as objects. But what I want to suggest is that you can also learn a lot about human beings in this other way, which is the way that the moral philosopher proceeds from. So moral truth is not a matter of discovering the way some objects are in the world. It's not like that. However, as truth, it still corresponds to reality. So how can we understand this? Is moral truth really objective if it's not knowledge of another object? In what sense is it really true? I'm just going to pose this question right now, and then I want to come back to it at the end. For now, I want to... So that was the self-knowledge part of the formula, that moral knowledge is practical self-knowledge, and now I want to focus on the practical part of that formula. What's practical knowledge? Well, when Aquinas talks about practical knowledge, he says it's the cause of what it understands, which is a mysterious formulation. What does that mean? If you look at Aquinas in the Treatise on Human Acts, Aquinas says that what's distinctive of human acts is that there's a principle of knowledge internal to them. And this makes it different from the way that animals act. And he says that while animals have knowledge of the ends they seek, humans have perfect knowledge of their ends. What does he mean by perfect knowledge? I think this means that when a human being acts, they know what they're doing, and they know why they're doing it. Okay, so I am sitting here giving a talk on moral truth. And anybody could ask me, why are you doing that? And I could say, well, you know, I'm a philosophy professor and I give talks. It's an important part of my job. I am a member of the Thomistic Institute. I support the Thomistic Institute and the mission of the Thomistic Institute. And if you keep pressing me, I could ultimately tell you, well, you know, I'm trying to live a life of wisdom. I think wisdom is important, and I want to try to help other people live that kind of life. So ultimately, my answer to the question about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it is going to bring in some vision I have about like how I ought to be living generally. And that vision of how I ought to be living generally is operative in my choices that I make, right? So in choosing to give talks for the Thomistic Institute and choosing to be here now, right, on March 13th at 7 p.m., I think that, you know, in some sense, I'm realizing my own vision of the good life. And this is what Aquinas means by perfect knowledge of the end. Right, so my end in acting right now is to give a talk. At some point, I'll be done giving this talk, I promise. But I'm able to relate that end to like all the other ends I have going on, right? That I'm a professor, that I'm a philosopher, that I'm a Catholic, that, you know, etc. And that sort of knowledge of how what I'm doing right now is justified by all these other things that I have going on, that's what Aquinas means by perfect knowledge of the end. And that sort of knowledge is what's characteristic of human actions. So I know my end in relation to my life as a whole and how I think I ought to be living. So what ultimately explains my action of giving a talk is my vision of happiness. This structures my practical deliberation. And I can discover this structure just by reflecting on my own activity. Now, I possess such knowledge of what I'm doing through the exercise of my practical intellect and my will. So I had to deliberate about what to do. I had to find reasons for doing what I'm currently doing, and make a choice and execute the choice, which is what I'm presently doing. I'm executing my choice. And I can only do this through that kind of knowledge, right? So if I didn't know, right, that I'm giving a talk right now, which would be really weird, and if I didn't know, like if I had no reason for giving it, then I couldn't be acting well, and I wouldn't be acting in the characteristically human way. So this kind of practical knowledge is the sort of knowledge that Aquinas thinks is characteristic of human action. And it's practical because my thought and my judgment about what to do determines what I do. So it is the cause of what it understands, in Aquinas' sense. So right now I'm giving a talk, that's the conclusion of my practical reasoning. That's how Aquinas understands action. It's the conclusion of a bit of practical deliberation. But how can I say whether my conclusion is good or bad? Does my action reflect good practical reasoning, or does it reflect poor judgment, poor reasoning? Am I really living well right now? I think in order to answer this, we need to think about what could make for good practical reasoning. Now, we know that good practical reasoning will result in an action that is living well, that can truthfully be described as living well. But how do you get to that? And here Aquinas insists that in order to deliberate well, you have to have the virtues. So a formal definition of virtue that Aquinas picks up from Aristotle is that a virtue is what is necessary to attain the characteristic, is a quality that's necessary to attain the characteristic activity of a thing. So the virtue of a knife is sharpness. Because what's the characteristic activity of a knife? It's to cut. A dull knife will not cut well. So the virtue of a knife is its sharpness. The virtues that we think of, so justice, prudence, temperance, fortitude or courage, these are characteristics of thought, action, and feeling. They are stable dispositions of character that make us ready to think, act, and feel, so experience emotions, in such a way as to live well, right? So they're necessary for us to perform our characteristic activity. What's the human person's characteristic activity? It's to live well according to reason. Because what makes us distinct from everything else is our capacity to reason. So that's a basic picture of virtue. But also, and maybe this is a little bit more familiar to you, we reason according to principles, right? And Aquinas thinks that in the practical sphere, we reason according to first principles. So in the theoretical sphere, the first principle is the principle of non-contradiction. And that's ultimately a claim about reality. So the principle of non-contradiction is that it can't be the case that both P and not P at the same time, where P just stands for any proposition. So just to fill in P, it can't be the case that at the same time, in the same place, in the same way, I'm both sitting and not sitting. I have to be doing one or the other. And ultimately, so I cannot think or assert or judge that I'm both sitting and not sitting, because that would be to contradict myself. It doesn't make sense. And that sort of like structures, that just structures theoretical thought. Like, you can't contradict yourself, at minimum. Now, there are other principles, but like that's the most basic one. And the fundamental explanation of that comes from the fact that reality can't contradict itself. So at the end of the day, for Aquinas, it's a claim about reality. And thought, insofar as thought tracks reality. Now, on the practical side, the first principle of practical reason, Aquinas says, is do good and avoid evil. Another way to construe that would just be to say, pursue happiness. But look, that's not that helpful, because it doesn't say what's good or what's evil. It just structures the nature of practical thought, right? Practical thought's good insofar as it is thought aimed at realizing the good and avoiding what's evil, okay? But Aquinas also thinks that there are certain things that it is connatural to us to know and desire, just in virtue of being human beings. So things like bodily health, family, political society, friendship, knowledge, these are things that all human communities recognize as valuable goods. And these first principles sort of structure the outer limits of what is practically intelligible to other human beings. So it's not just that each one of us kind of naturally comes to see these things as good and we naturally want them, but also we sort of like can only make sense of one another insofar as we're operating under these first principles. And now I think of this connatural knowledge as a kind of practical self-knowledge of our own nature. So Aquinas thinks that we do have this knowledge of our own nature, just in virtue of living a characteristically human life. So, like, you don't have to be taught that these things are good. You just kind of naturally see that they're good. In a way, they're sort of self-evident to you, and you naturally desire them. Now, remember that the first principle of practical reason says, do good and avoid evil. Right? So the first principles of practical reason that are robust goods, that's the do good part, but there's also an avoid evil part. Aquinas thinks that there are absolute prohibitions that structure practical deliberation. So that would be the avoid evil part of the principle. And here are the ideas that some actions, because of their nature, can never be choice-worthy, okay? They're never good because they're fundamentally opposed to human happiness. So if you think about the Ten Commandments, there are some great examples in the Ten Commandments of things you can never do because they just contradict human goodness. Adultery, lying, stealing, cheating, apostasy, worshiping false gods, and murder, for instance. There's never a good time or a good way or a good reason for doing these. They're just always bad. And so someone who's a good practical reasoner will never consider doing these, right? They're never options. They're ruled out. So they'll never deliberate about whether or not to murder someone. It's just like not on the table. And that also functions as a kind of first principle. Because in avoiding evil, we preserve the good. And in fact, we can't preserve the good unless we avoid what is intrinsically evil. Okay, so I can say more about the virtues later if you want, but I think just for the sake of time, I just want to say the following, because I do want to say something about conscience. So the only remaining thing that I want to say about virtue is the following. We have these first principles, but that's not going to get us. So, like, everybody has these Aquinas things. So why doesn't everybody act well? Well, because not everybody has virtue. In fact, most of us don't. So the cultivation of virtue means the following. Through the performance of good acts, we train our desires and our pleasures such that we come to see the world in a certain way. So if I moderate my sensual desire, for example, which at first it's difficult, but eventually I come to see that the right amount of bodily pleasure is the amount that seems appealing to me. When I moderate my fears, right, so that I have fortitude or courage, I come to see the world, and I only fear what it's appropriate to fear in the appropriate times. And so basically what the cultivation of virtue does is allow me to see things clearly. And if I don't cultivate virtue, if I have disordered desires and disordered passions, I'm actually unable to judge things clearly. Now, there are a million examples of this I could give, but I'll just stick to Aquinas' favorite, which is Peter's denial of Christ. So Christ says to Peter that you will deny me three times. And he says this to Peter, like, in a cool hour, and Peter's horrified. He's like, I would never do that to you. I love you. You're my friend. And you know, Christ is like, you're going to deny me three times. And sure enough, when Peter fears for his life, he denies Christ three times. It's not that. So what's the explanation of Peter's sin? Because it was a sin. The explanation isn't that he didn't know. It's not like there was some knowledge he lacked. He was scared. He was completely terrified, understandably. He was scared, and his fear distracted him from, you know, his love for Christ. And his fear led him to make a really disastrous choice in the moment, right? And that's when we make practical judgment, like in the moment. These people are probably going to kill you. What are you going to do? That's a really high pressure situation. And Peter failed in that moment. And as soon as the threat vanished, Peter went outside and wept, right? That's what it says in the gospel. He immediately, as soon as he was no longer afraid, he was like, oh my gosh, I betrayed Christ. And that just underscores the necessity of fortitude. If Peter had fortitude, he would not have betrayed Christ. Now, it's understandable, right? When your life is on the line, and of course, like, Peter would eventually give his life for Christ. So Peter would obviously grow in virtue. But in this moment, he failed. But the explanation of his failure isn't that, like, there was something he didn't know. It was that his passion really overcame him. And that's just to underscore something that Aquinas teaches, which I think is extremely important, and that is that in order to have practical wisdom, where practical wisdom is the ability to make the right judgment in the circumstances, which are always changing, right? The circumstances are always in flux, and sometimes they're really terrible and hard. In order to be stably disposed to judge well in the circumstances, you have to have virtue. You have to have rightly ordered desires, or it's just not going to happen. Okay, so that's virtue. I want to say something really fast about conscience. Conscience. In some sense, I've already said something about it, because the first principles of practical reason that I've been talking about are kind of a primordial conscience. And that's one sense of conscience that we think about. Conscience is just your ability to judge good from bad. Right? So there's, like, these general judgments that we have, which I think, like, we tend on the whole to mostly get right. I mean, there are obvious examples of people having a poorly formed conscience, but, like, most people know that murder is wrong. Like, it's not that hard. Or that stealing is wrong. I mean, people might justify stealing, but, like, really they know it's wrong. And so that's one sense of conscience. But another sense of conscience that Aquinas discusses is the kind of judgment that you make that determines your choice, right? And that second notion of conscience is much closer to the ground. So, like, these general judgments that we make, like, I'm sitting here talking about ethics, and I make all kinds of general judgments. Okay, it's fine, you know, it's not that hard. But so I can tell you, you know, temperance is good, but, like, am I going to have that third drink at the party tomorrow night, or am I going to refrain? That particular judgment is also a judgment of conscience. And that particular judgment is harder to get right. So a lot of people are right at a very general and abstract level, but, like, the further they get to the particular, the more they go wrong. So lots of people will acknowledge, yeah, family's good, that's important. First principle, yeah. But then, like, how do I preserve family? And then the closer I get to that, the more I'm likely to go astray. So suppose that I'm infertile. Should I pay someone to be a surrogate mother? Should I undergo IVF? All of these questions, right? I understand that family is a good, right? But it's just how do I best realize that good in my life? Should I adopt a child, given how many children are in need of a loving home? Or should I pay exorbitant amounts of money to freeze embryos, knowing that many of them are just going to be discarded, et cetera, et cetera? Those are both judgments of conscience. You're more likely to get the general one right and the particular one wrong. The space between the general and the particular really underscores the need for virtue. You should always follow your conscience. Even if your conscience is misinformed, you should still follow your conscience. And the reason why is that not following your conscience, to do what you know is wrong, is malice. And that's the worst form of sin. So you should not do that, because that's really destructive of the moral life. But you should also really try to have a well-formed conscience. How do you have a well-formed conscience? Here Aquinas just says, well, look, there's law and custom. So there's your first principles. That only gets you so far. There's law and custom. That's also only going to get you so far, especially if you're in a corrupt society. There's also whoever you take as a moral authority in your life. So for most people, that's their parents or extended members of the family that are, you know, invested with some kind of moral authority. But there's also the idea of an exemplar. Moral exemplars are actually, like, really important to coming to have moral knowledge. So people whose lives we try to imitate. For Catholics, you know, that tends to be the saints. But of course, each saint is trying to imitate Christ. So, like, ultimately, the exemplar is Christ, a virtuous life, a person who strives to grow in virtue. And so to have a well-formed conscience is someone who is striving to imitate Christ. And of course, someone who's striving to do that is going to look to the church as a special moral authority. Okay, so just to conclude, I've been talking about moral truth, and I've said that the truth has to be practical and that it involves a kind of self-knowledge. But in what sense, then, is it objective? I think it's in no sense objective, so long as we think that moral truth is truth about objects in the world. So long as we're holding to that picture of knowledge as the only kind of knowledge, there is no objective moral truth. But if we drop that picture, which I think we should, and I don't think that Aquinas operates under that picture, then we can have an account of practical truth. And practical truth is, like all truth, still a relation to reality. So there's no concept of truth that isn't a relation to reality or being. Now, what makes a judgment practically true is both its relation to the reality of the human person and the goods that constitute a good life for a human person, the kind of thing that we are. Also, the reality of the situation, right, that determines the judgment. But it necessarily involves, and this is what makes it practical, a relation to right desire. So you can't have practical truth without right desire. And of course, to have right desire is to be, in an objective sense, a good human person. And so I think we can say something like, to be good is to do the truth. And the person who possesses practical truth is a good person, is a person who is such as to live well, or is living well, and is someone who is objectively, in the sense of fullness of reality or something, a good human being. But this is compatible with its being a kind of self-knowledge. So when we have that knowledge of what it is to be a good human being, it is a kind of self-knowledge, a knowledge of the kind of thing that we are, and not knowledge of another object in the world. So I'll stop there.
Does certain sense of every violation of reason, all reason, involve fear?
Involve fear?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've never thought about it, but I don't think so, because when sometimes it's just ignorance, right? So when in the Treatise on Sin in the Summa, Aquinas identifies three causes of sin. Ignorance, so like you just don't know, so then you sin. Passion, and not just fear, so sometimes sensual desire is the reason why your practical judgment gets totally messed up. But Aquinas also discusses malice. Malice is when you sin knowing full well that what you're doing is a sin. So the most famous case of this is from Augustine's Confessions. So you may remember when Augustine is talking about stealing the pear, and he's like, yeah, I wasn't hungry and the pears weren't even really good. And honestly, I just did it because I knew it was wicked. And then he's like, oh, Lord, I'm sorry, I'm so depraved. But, like, he's like, how is this possible? Like, I didn't even need anything. I just stole because it was stealing. And that seemed, like, glamorous to me. So that's what Aquinas calls malice. And the reason why malice is so bad is that the defect, the cause of the sin, is in the will itself and not something external to the will. So ignorance is a defect of intellect, and maybe it's your fault, maybe it's not. Passions are a default in the passions. But malice is just selfishness. It's in the will itself. It's when you choose yourself over God. Well, that's Augustine's diagnosis. And he thinks we are absolutely capable of this. Angels are too, for example. This explains the fall of the devil, which is otherwise deeply inexplicable, because there's nothing the devil didn't know. It's not like he was confused. It's not like he didn't know that God was more powerful than him. It's that he was wounded that God was more powerful than him. It hurt his pride. And that's malice. So I don't think for that reason that fear is involved. For example, the devil can't feel fear. Angels don't have passions, but they can sin. Yes, what's your name?
Oh, my name is Andrew Morrison. Okay. Tony, you can ask this talk tonight. When I when we talk about, you know, virtue and essences and truth, I'm very comfortable. I understand how it works with Aquinas' philosophy.
Yeah.
And everything is ordered towards a transcendent, loving God.
Yeah.
And my question is if you go back to Aristotle, he doesn't have a transcendent, loving God at the top of the hierarchy, right? And how does he avoid becoming basically, you know, the first kind of will to power philosopher and ending up saying things like the virtue of a criminal was being really good at committing crime?
So I think one of the things that I really like about Aquinas, so I was raised in a religiously indifferent household, so my parents weren't Christians, but they weren't anything else either. So there was like no God in my house. But there was a lot of morality. And one of the things that I liked about Aquinas is that he could explain why that was the case. So I don't think, Aquinas doesn't think that you need to believe in the Christian God in order to know right from wrong. And I actually find that very appealing about his view, because I think it's true. I think that Aristotle was deeply insightful about the difference between right and wrong, and Plato was too. But I will also say that Aristotle did have a God. He's not the Christian God. Aristotle's God is thought, thinking, thought. but Aristotle thought the highest activity we could engage in was contemplation of God. And Aquinas agrees with him about that. So what's missing from Aristotle isn't God. It's friendship with God. Aristotle is a pagan, and he does not think that we can have friendship with God. But he thinks we can contemplate God, and that we should contemplate God. And that the practical life, when it's well-ordered, leaves a lot of space for contemplating God. What makes Aquinas... Well, there are a lot of things that make Aquinas different, but Aquinas has a similar structure to Aristotle, so Aquinas also thinks that the highest good is contemplating God. He thinks that our perfect happiness consists in the beatific vision, when we see God's essence. But it's a loving contemplation, right? And that union with God is driven by love and is ultimately a form of friendship, the highest form of friendship. And so it's a very personal communion. And that, for Aristotle, is not possible, because Aristotle's God does not care about us at all. And he's also not a creator God. Aristotle's world is eternal. So it's not a... Aristotle's God isn't transcendent in the sense that the Christian God is. But I think that there's a lot of similarities between pagan philosophy and Christianity than are often acknowledged. I mean, there are very deep and important differences. But I think that, you know, Aquinas and Augustine both drew very heavily from pagan philosophers. Augustine from Plato, and Aquinas more from Aristotle. But there's a lot there. And so I think Aristotle wouldn't at all have been tempted by the kind of Callicles figure that you're talking about. And of course, Callicles is a figure from the dialogues of Plato. So Plato in the Republic and in other dialogues considers this kind of amoralist, right, who thinks that it's the unjust man and the wicked who prosper and flourish like the bay tree. And the whole point of the Republic is to show that that's false, that justice benefits its possessor, which is a funny thing for Socrates to say, or for Plato to put in the mouth of Socrates, given that Socrates was executed, right, by the Athenian state, you know, for saying things like that. So I think that this was not at all a temptation for these pagan philosophers. This is a temptation that arises in people like Nietzsche, this kind of, well, it's all just will to power. And I think that arises as a result of kind of like taking nature completely out of things and seeing that, you know, there's not much left, right? There's just my will. When nature puts no limits on me, there's just my will. Yeah. Yes. And what was your name?
Oh, sorry, Antonio.
Antonio?
Yeah. So I work with trauma and I'm a therapist, and I think, you know, the practical knowledge thing is very practical. Like, I really enjoy the way you just said that, because it's very practical to help people. So, like, I'm going back to, like, Peter's denial of Christ. So, like, people get so stuck on the wrong that they do, right? So, like, that's a, just kind of, like, could you talk more about that piece? Because that really, like, because about the fear and his question and about trauma and people making bad decisions out of fear and trauma. So, like, just, can you talk more about that?
Well, so are you interested in, like, how people overcome their fears? Or
how do they overcome their fears but then not act on them?
Yeah, so I think fear, that's a hard question.
Yeah, no, I'm asking a very hard question.
Let me just acknowledge that.
Yeah.
That's super tricky.
Yeah.
But I think that the general account that Aquinas gives, so with sensual passion, what we have to do is moderate. But on the fear side, you have to sort of like, it's not so much about moderating as it is about curbing or restraining. And so you're going to tackle your fears in a very different way, than your, sensual desires for bodily pleasure, because the passion operates on you in a totally different way. So with fears, and it gets a little tricky and complicated, and I think that here we have a lot to learn from psychologists, actually, who have a lot to teach us about sort of like how fear does and doesn't operate in human beings. But I think that people have to... you kind of have to go through this experience where you prove to yourself that you can stand it.
Yeah.
So people who are really afraid of flying have to fly. Like, you have to do it.
Yeah.
And people who are... So I have a son. It's complicated because he has autism, but he's, like, so scared of dogs. Like, it's insane. But... how have we dealt with this? Constant exposure to dogs. Like, and it's awful. I mean, it's a lot better now, actually, but in the beginning it was so terrible. And I sort of felt like maybe I was torturing him. But it's the only path. Because, like, basically, like, you have, like, you're sort of training at a sub-rational level, because a lot of this, like, isn't rational at all. You have to train, I mean, a lot of it's bodily, but you basically have to train various bodily systems to stop triggering certain things.
You answered it very well.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, that was huge.
And so, just not to like beat it to death, but actually, like, so if you think about people who are trying to overcome like gluttony, a lot of that has to do with retraining your body too. So actually, so for someone who's accustomed to junk food, healthy food tastes really bad. And again, this is like proven. And so part of what's necessary is forcing yourself to have really unpleasant experiences of like eating fruit. And eventually, your palate does change. It takes time, and it takes a lot of dedication, and it's super unpleasant for a while. And in fact, sometimes your body like doesn't even know how to process healthy food. But if you keep at it, we know for a matter of fact that your body will change, unless like you have a disease or something, in which case all bets are off. The same is true of fasting. the first time that people fast, it is very, very hard. And you have very physical reactions. You shake, you're nauseated, you might pass out. If you stick with it, your body, again, at a completely subrational level, recalibrates, your metabolism changes, and you'll no longer experience these kinds of bodily upheavals. But again, you have to go through a lot of unpleasantness. Yes?
Is what you're saying coming from sort of the insights of like cognitive behavioral therapy?
For what, the fear? Or?
Yeah, the fear one I was thinking of in particular.
So I don't know exactly what they call themselves, but when I did my big project, there was a woman who, I think she just called herself a behavioral psychologist, but she worked in an emotions lab, right? And she pointed me to like all these studies. But the thing is, like, psychologists, they've got all kinds of names, and I don't know. It's hard to keep track. It's like philosophers are just philosophers, whatever.
Yeah, I think it's like the cognitive part is so, like, sometimes we just have a normal experience, and we have the tendency to form these irrational beliefs based on the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the cognitive part of it apparently is like trying to train your mind to not do that. But then the behavioral part of it, I think, is kind of what you were talking about in terms of disciplining yourself with, you know, these irrational fears that you have. That's more of sort of this, you know, rational.
Yeah, so emotions are really complicated. And one of the things that I really like about Aquinas on the Passions is that he respects that. He recognizes that emotions involve bodily dispositions that have to be trained, okay? They have to be trained so as to align with reason. And, like, that's not going to happen naturally. So there's bodily dispositions. There's a cognitive element. It's about the way you're perceiving things and what you're focused on. So it's about directed attention. And it is true that a lot of regulation of emotions is redirecting your attention. And then also the desire aspect. And that's why growth and moral virtue, you know, takes so much dedication and work, because knowledge is important, but only gets you so far. In fact, it doesn't get you very far. And that's why moral truth has to involve right desire. And that's another reason why it's not just like objects, you know? Like, I can know chairs in the heart. Yes, Louis.
I have a question about, so this section titled Moral Knowledge is practice of self-knowledge.
Yeah,
I'm
wondering
about the is in there, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I guess the question is really, is this a form of ethical egoism of a certain kind, where, like, the goal is to be happy for yourself, and that just happens to involve also being, like,
what a great question. I wrote a paper on this. The answer is no. I wrote a paper on this, which I'll send to you, and you can tell me if it convinced you or not. But the thing that I would need to say in order to answer that question, I haven't said, and that is that Aquinas understands happiness as a common good. And so, what's characteristic of a common good? It's common to all of us in virtue of our nature, so it's universal. It's non-competitive, so my going after and getting the good in no way competes with your going after it and getting it, but most fundamentally it's participatory. So a common good is something that we participate in together. So in my paper I talk about friendship, because for Aquinas the happy life is a life of friendship. Perfect happiness is friendship with God. But friendship and this life are the deep, loving relationships that make our lives truly meaningful. Friendship is participatory. And friends share a common goal. So friends will the good of each other. But that means that if we're really friends, your happiness can't really be separated from my happiness. So if you're unhappy, I'm unhappy. If you suffer, I suffer. If you flourish, I flourish. Like, we're bound up together. And this aspect, and this, by the way, is Aristotle's view as well. is completely neglected by contemporary Aristotelians. And so I think that a lot of contemporary neo-Aristotelians are susceptible to the egoism charge. I don't think Aquinas is. I don't think Aristotle is. But people just don't read Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics. It's like it never happened. I don't know if it's because like it has some math in it or what, but nobody cares about justice, but actually like it's all justice and friendship. I mean, and for Aristotle, friendship is higher than justice, right? The just need friends, but friends don't need justice. Like, they've transcended that. What does that mean? It means they love each other, right? They no longer merely respect one another's rights. They love each other. So I don't think that it's egoism, but I haven't said the necessary part yet.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
So I guess that tells me something about the is, but I'm not sure yet totally.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that. So the moral, as I understand it, normally is about like our relationship with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And ourself is like one example of it, but it's about like how to treat people. And that's like,
yeah.
It really doesn't distinguish between me and others, but others are definitely constitutive of it.
Uh-huh.
And so if I read that as the kind of moral involved in the moral knowledge is practical self-knowledge, it sounds like moral knowledge is something you know about by looking.
Oh, so, well, look, consider this. There isn't just the first person singular, there's the first person plural,
mm-hmm.
right? The we. And also consider that if you ask the question, what is a human being, the correct answer is a rational, political animal, right? What does it mean to be a political animal? It means that I only flourish in political society with others. So my happiness is a common good. I mean, it's the fact that we're a political animal the highest goods are common goods. And not all goods are common goods. Like, my health, that's not common. It's my health. Right? But for that reason, it's a lower level good. Right? And there's a hierarchy of goods for Aristotle and Aquinas. And God is the highest common good. Yeah.
Yeah, you were, it was actually in reference when you were talking about malice.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the definition of sin, all sin be malice because we are choosing ourselves over God?
Yeah, what a good question. You sound like an Augustinian. okay, I'm going to give you Aquinas' answer. I think that what you said is very Augustinian, so that's one, you know. Aquinas says that sin is inordinate self-love. All sin is inordinate self-love. So all sin is in some sense prioritizing the self above others. But that doesn't mean that all sin is malice. Because you could think of sins of passions and sins of ignorance as forms of negligence, right? So negligence just comes from the Latin nec elegans, which is failure to choose. So actually, a lot of our worst moral failings are negligence, like things that we're not attending to that we should be attending to. And so you could think of sins of passion as failure to attend to the necessity of cultivating virtue. And you can think of sins of ignorance as failing to attend to what you could and should know. But malice is like, you're just actively, you know, choosing what you know is bad. And I think that's slightly different. And so I don't think that all sin is malice, but I understand why you're saying that. But I do think that all sin is inordinate self-love, because the answer so like the ultimate explanation of why I don't attend to the things I should be attending to is that in some sense I'm, you know, prioritizing myself, or I'm failing to prioritize others in the right way. Yeah. I do really think that there's an important difference between sense of malice and sense of weakness. Because think about when once Peter is no longer afraid, he goes outside and weeps. Augustine doesn't weep over his son until he's like a converted Christian years later. You know, there's someone who sends from malice, like, doesn't care necessarily. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people who sin from malice actually rejoice in it. So the vicious person, you know, they choose what is bad, and that's what pleases them. Yeah, Bill.
How does the sin of malice jive with the notion of Aquinas, like, as I understand it, that our wills are directed toward the good, and that when we choose, we really don't choose evil directly.
What a good question.
We do evil things.
What a hard question.
We redirect our to the apparent good. So
I wrote a paper on this. Because it is a good question. And it is a hard question. So I wrote a paper on it trying to figure it out. Basically what Aquinas says is that you don't directly intend the evil. You foresee it. So take a greedy person, right, who commits fraud in order to keep accumulating wealth. So he chooses fraud, knowing that it's sin, right? But that it's sin doesn't explain why he chooses the fraud, right? He chooses the fraud, the fraudulent act, because he wants more wealth, which is a good, right? So that's what he wants in choosing the fraud. But he sees that it is a consequence of this is that it's a sin. But he's not, as it were, directly intending the sinful character of it. He's intending, you know, the good, the wealth. And so he has a distinction between what you directly intend and what you merely foresee is a result of your intention. That's what he says.
So where's the word?
Oh, because you know that it's evil. And you just don't care.
They are reconcilable.
Well, it depends on how you feel about that explanation. But that is what he says. I mean, I actually worried a lot about this. That's a good question.
If we can thank our speaker, please.
Thank you.